In my previous series of podcasts, I've been having conversations on why and how people take conscious breaks from work. There are many reasons why people take breaks, and one of those reasons is burnout. I suspect that I might also have been approaching burnout before I took my conscious sabbatical, although I never really got there. But I was juggling a lot of things, all of my own doing, and some days it could be quite overwhelming. In the next two episodes of Unchange, I'm diving deeper into what causes burnouts and how it might be prevented and managed. Today in the studio, I have two fellow coaches who have worked with clients that have burned out or need to find coping strategies for burnout. Welcome in the studio, Laura Jean and Lorinda.
Hi. Hello.
Very nice to have you with me.
Great to be here.
Briefly introduce yourselves and tell us what you're doing at the moment.
I'm Laura Jean Evans, and I'm an executive coach. My background is industrial psychology, and I worked for 25 years in leadership development, organizational effectiveness, and then I moved across to coaching to come alongside businesses as opposed to being in the business itself, and also have done change management. And then I'm particularly passionate about well-being. I'm the wellness ambassador for the Bryanston Country Club. And yeah, have my own burnout story.
Mm-hmm. And you, Lorinda?
Yes, I'm an industrial psychologist and applied theatre specialist. And I do individual and team consultations with a system psychodynamic approach. And I'm based in Randburg. And I'm an all-round fun gal.
Well, nice to have you guys with me. So like I was saying in my latest series of podcasts, I've been interviewing people who have taken conscious breaks from work. And the concept of burnout came up quite a lot. So what exactly is burnout in your definition, Laura?
So burnout is not a rare condition. But in fact, SADAG, the South African Depression and Anxiety Group, say that one in four people have burnout. So what it is extreme exhaustion, loss of motivation, anxiety. It can take many shapes and forms, can look like panic attacks, insomnia, loss of motivation. And I think there's also a lot to be said for the disconnection or loneliness that contributes to burnout. The loneliness pandemic says that we're in a society with social media and so much connectivity, and yet we find ourselves quite isolated and alone. And then the last point that I think is linked to burnout, which is often overlooked, is as women, the menopause, there's similar symptoms, anxiety, insomnia, and yeah, plays a role.
What are the warning signs that somebody might be approaching burnout?
I think in my practice, it's three things I look at. First of all, that overwhelming exhaustion that Laura was referring to now, as well as like a detachment or cynicism around your job. And then inefficacy is the third one. So inefficacy, when I sit with someone in front of me, I don't really ask the direct questions because in my opinion, they never give me truthful answers. So I ask around something to get to it. And if I want to check with the person if they have that extreme exhaustion, I usually go into body clues. So I'll ask them about any patterns in any physical things like headaches and insomnia. And so that'll be a clue to me. And then with regard to detachment and cynicism, just the wording they use when they speak about their jobs. Is it negative overall? Do they have a positive regard for what they're doing and for the people they're working with or not? And do they still have the ability to make generous assumptions about things and people? Because I think when they lose that, that's a big clue as well. And then in terms of self-doubt, where you get to the inefficacy of not having a belief in your own abilities. This one for me, like Laura also mentioned, it's very complex because it coincides with other things, but especially the inefficacy, the self-doubt and doubting your own decisions. So massive indecisiveness, that kind of stuff is very similar to organizational bullying and emotional abuse. So there you have to almost ask for me, I always look for whether it's connected to a personal situation or whether it's in general. So if there's a if it's in general, then we know that is more burnout than it is something else. So those are the three things I look for. And then also if the person is very self-critical, when they have that feelings of inefficacy, how do they deal with themselves in terms of self-talk? And do they have self-compassion or not? And if they have no self-compassion, that is also something that I look for. Yeah, so those are the things I look for when I try to determine if someone is on the edge of burnout, because I think a lot of the time people don't know.
I mean, I can remember feeling very, very overwhelmed in my job at certain points in time. But then at the other side, I would also never say no to anything. So it would be, you know, I would take on so much stuff. And eventually you're like, okay, how do I keep all of these balls in the air at the same time? So it's like probably a fine line between, you know, taking on too much and being overwhelmed and then burnouts and all of that. So how do you think employees unwittingly contribute towards their own burnout?
Yeah, I loved what, you know, your real feedback there. And there's a beautiful quote that Stephen Covey says. He says, "We achieve inner peace when our schedules are aligned to our values." And I think that's where it goes wrong. The SA Board for People Practices say that 66% of South African employees have actually experience some sort of stress and burnout due to work-related pressures. And I think it starts with like a real intense love of what you're doing and a drive, and it looks quite positive with what you're doing. But then drive merges into overdrive. An activity and some of the activities that you're really enjoying then become a frenzy of busy schedules. I think it starts to slip when we don't prioritize time out. That can look like just a lunch break, a walk outside. I heard a podcast by Mel Robbins that said a walk solves 95% of our problems. And it's about being intentional, about taking a strategic pause within your day. It doesn't always have to be a holiday, although prioritizing holidays is like really important. I coach someone who would just work over December and just found that eventually, he lost the motivation. So Juliet Funt's got a book called The Minute to Think, and she talks about just taking a pause in your day, like a wedge of time. She's got some great strategies about how to do that. And I think the main thing is to balance our contribution, which we often very excited about, with restoration, and have this really good ebb and flow so that we stay on top. Another quote I have is by Laurie Santos. She said, "The happiest people all choose time over money, more time in relationships in particular, because that's where the good life is."
Yeah, that resonates with me so well, because I think what actually drove my decision to take a sabbatical was more around the discussion of time. How do I want to spend my time? You know, do I want to spend it doing what I was doing at that point in time, or do I want to spend it on something else? Mm-hmm. And then eventually I got to the point where I went, you know, you only get 4,000 weeks in life. So how do I want to spend it with the company? Doing stuff that it's okay, but doesn't really, you know, really get me going? Or do I want to, you know, get out there and do something different? And it all boiled down to time in the end. Lorinda, do you think that company culture can be blamed for burnout?
I think the word blamed is a bit loaded.
We can use a different word.
I think definitely that culture is, the onus is on the employer to create a culture and environment where people will have the lowest risk of getting into burnout. And in one of the studies I read, there is there's 7 organizational risk factors. And if you read them for burnout, and that is command and control environments, rewards, fairness, values, workload, and community. And if you think about it, all of those are part of culture and how things are experienced at work.
Yeah.
So obviously it is intertwined with it. But I think for me, again, the questions I ask when I work with teams in organizations and I work within a system, I look for three flag things. The first is, how do they reward and punish? And how do people feel about punishment in specific? So are they scared of punishment? Is there fear around punishment? Because that drives something in the system to say that I need to not make mistakes. Mm. And that's my second one, zero tolerance for mistakes in terms of the experience, not in terms of what they say. Because sometimes people say, no, we have an open door policy. Here we learn from our mistakes as long as we learn from our mistakes. But actually on the ground, people are so scared that they're going to make a mistake, that they have so much anxiety to make mistakes that they start doing more and more and more to make sure that they can't make a mistake. You know, the idea of meetings for meetings for meetings so that we're prepared in the meeting and on the same page. Those are all signs that people are scared to make mistakes. And then the third one is, how does the leadership react and do they have emotional integrity? Do they say what they mean what they say? And does it filter through into the day-to-day operations? Can you see it on the ground? So those things to me is very important. But the reason I say it's loaded is because for me, everything is in the dynamics. And to your point earlier, there are people, it's a dance between what is given to you and how you react to it or how you collude with some things. So people with a type A personality, people who are traumatized, people who have been oppressed and they live in that like inner world of oppression. It gives you a certain worldview and certain thoughts and certain approaches. And that makes you collude with certain things in how the culture is set up. So I do think that the type of culture that's high command control, very zero tolerance on mistakes, is like, it's like a breeding ground for type A personalities, because what you mentioned earlier is they want to go and do everything.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want to say no. And then the culture provides the rewards for that. So I do think it's that dance, and it's in understanding how that dance works and what companies can adjust, which I call lever activities. What lever can you pull that can change a lot of things for the organization? And that is all for me, like you said, in the culture.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. I was doing a little bit of research before. Actually, not research. I was reading LinkedIn. And there's so many articles on LinkedIn about burnout. Okay, if you just search for burnout in LinkedIn, there's a lot of people who've posted things on how you can actually not burnout, or what might lead to it and what sort of personality traits might get you to burnout. And there's sort of, I just want to read these seven. So there are seven traps that cause burnout. Okay. And the first one is people pleasing. And I had somebody on the podcast who told me a whole story about people pleasing. The second is perfectionism. You know, you just want to have to be perfect all the time. You're obsessing about being flawless and you want perfect results. And then you're going to constantly try and, do more work. A lack of boundaries. You know, so if you say yes to everything, then you're going to take on too much. Like, I was definitely guilty of that. Mm. Self-limiting beliefs, accepting negative thoughts that might limit your potential, a lack of self-compassion. And I think you touched on that as well. If you've got a specific worldview, resistance to change, and then trying to live somebody else's life. You know, not living your own authentic life, you might take on too much. And that might all lead to you eventually burning out. So how do you help a client who has completely burned out?
Yeah, I just want to respond to what you were saying about personalities. And I actually did a talk on PACE, personalities and pathways to well-being. Because I work with the Enneagram, and definitely there's certain personalities, enthusiastic, visionary, 7, 8, the strategic direction, 3, the competitive achiever, and you can hear the pace of all of those 3. It's fast and it's driven in an unhealthy space. And then there's personalities where it's slower. It's more about withdrawing and just considering what your body feels like. And it's amazing how there's an overlap and an interlink, and it's about watching that and seeing where to slow down. But there are points at which there is no return at some point. There's always a return, but for helping someone who's completely burnt out, again, I want to say there's a person who walked this road, Greg Anderson. His quote is, the pathway to wellness is about integrating the body, mind, and spirit, because it's about, in his quote, he says, it's about a realization that all we do and think and feel and believe affects our well-being. And I think when we like let that really sink into our personalities, and then we have to assess what we're doing, thinking and feeling according to, you know, the pace. I think that's part of it, is coaching, coming alongside people. There is a point at which it's not like coaching and positive psychology, it's therapy that's very necessary. I did work with someone who went first through therapy and then got to a point that they could surface and actually begin to connect to hope. So I think hope is important. I think a realization of healthy disciplines, you know, to stop, you actually have to stop. You can't do anything else, having walked this journey myself. And I think also just in terms of helping someone with burnout, we always feel like we have to fix something. In a state of burnout, that person really just needs us to, the Jewish have a saying called sit shiver. Just sit there with you. Just empathize, be with you, and hold the space, as opposed to feeling like we have to fix it, or as opposed to not knowing what to do with it and abandoning the situation or the person. So I think really to hold space. And I have a friend, a psychologist who works a lot with people, Kevin Newst, and I loved his analogy. He said, you know, as a coach or as a therapist, our job is to build the house, the scaffolding for the house. And then that person's job is to rebuild it one brick at a time through these things, through these strategies.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a story of a client that came to you for help after burnouts, and what happened and how did you help them to recover?
Yes, I have had a client who, I've got two. The one that we figured out she is in burnout and she didn't know, and it was quite a big realization for her, but then I referred her to a clinical psychologist, and she just sent me a message later to say she's in therapy, and it's been her biggest takeaway from that was that she wasn't aware how bad it was. And I think that is a common story. And then I usually get people when they're either in the burnout or after the burnout. And for me, the biggest thing we do in therapy then is we work, I call it the journey back to the self, because there's so much disconnect in this that you can't locate yourself. And I feel like when we can start locating ourselves, we can start reevaluating how we relate to things. And then that becomes the journey. And the moment we know where we are and what we like and what we want out of life, then we can connect to others and to ideas and to jobs and to roles and to all those things. So that's the work we do together. But I think the biggest thing that that I enjoy doing with people is just finding pockets of joy in every day. Because that's the other thing. You're so focused on all the negative stuff and what it does to you. And that you kind of forget that there's still things we enjoy and that we love. And it's like looking forward to those things. And then at the end, it meant for that person transitioning to a different job and a different job role. And sometimes that's not what you think. I think the biggest lesson for me is that every individual case is completely different. And once you do start with the self and move from there outwards, that's when they start to realize, okay, but this environment isn't good for me. And I'm colluding with things in these kinds of systems. So let's start looking to put you up, like setting people up for success. That is then what happened. She had to transition to a different job. And she really just phoned me afterwards and said she never knew that work can be such a pleasure.
Yeah.
So it's as if when you're stuck in it, you don't know there's a way out.
Yeah, it's quite interesting. I mean, one of my favorite executive coaches is Jerry Colonna. He's like the coach with the spider tattoo or something like that. But one of his favorite questions in life is, how are you complicit in a situation that you say you don't want? Which is a quite interesting question. You know, you inside a situation you say you don't want, but you act in a way that makes that situation keep happening over and over again? Mm. You know, so it's quite a nice question to ask the clients as well.
Mm.
Do you have a story about somebody who helped back from burnout, Laura?
Yeah, definitely. I actually could almost mark back to before COVID, because, I mean, obviously COVID, there was a lot that happened in that space. But yeah, in 2019, I remember coaching someone who was a PA to a global company, and just around anxiety. And 2020, just someone who heads up a whole retail space in South Africa. And it was also anxiety and burnout. And then, yeah, lots of the in different cultures, work cultures, I think quite driven, you know, scorecard driven, like banks, and that, you know, there are a lot of people who experience this drive and don't prioritize tapping out. So yeah, I've worked with people who have had to disconnect from just that performance drive. And also then the screen time, you know, as a result of COVID, and then afterwards, and just constantly on the screen with a hybrid approach and working from home. And then just how, you know, to actually disconnect from that and reconnect with family. Those are so many stories, and I went through my own story. So I just thought I'd tell that story. Was loving what I was doing. I was actually in a change management role and, just thriving on the engagement, and what was really, happening is that it was stimulating and fun, but I mean, it wasn't like fun enjoyment like I get when I go on an adventurous holiday, but it was great. I felt good. What I wasn't paying attention to was my sleep. So I was working hard, putting a lot of effort in, and not sleeping well. I wasn't paying attention to my nutrition and what was going in. We were just working in a room, and like it was go, go, go to get to a deadline. And it was for a very serious situation. This person who was the CEO had to tell not only his employees, but the market on a listed, it is a listed company, you know, what, the restructure would look like. And that can cause a lot of angst for people and for employees. So there was a lot of strategizing. And, I just didn't pay attention to myself in the process, my sleep, my nutrition. I let my exercise slip. I usually run about 4 times a week in nature. And it's like an embedded strategy for me. It works. It helps everything. It helps slow down. And, all of the disciplines that are healthy in my life, I guess I let slip. And that is when I went and I hit the wall, and I just had to disengage. I know, having worked with people, it can take years for people to recover from burnout, in some cases 4 years, 2 years, clients that I've worked with. For me, thankfully, it took like 2 weeks for me to get my mind in the right space again. But then I took 3 months to slow down and just pay attention to the strategies. The rhythms, the rule of life that is in place. So Brené Brown says, we don't always rise to the heights of our aspirations. We fall to the level of our systems. So what are those healthy strategies and systems in our lives? Thankfully, mine were in place. And I think that was part of my journey to recovery and why it was so fast.
Mm. Yeah.
Silence, solitude, getting into nature. Yeah.
Yeah, normally a sign for me that I'm heading towards some sort of meltdown is my desk gets so cluttered, okay, that I go, okay, I actually can't take this anymore. And then I have to clean my desk. And then everything is, you know, then it's almost as if my mind starts decluttering as well if I clean everything out on the desk, because the piles start going up on the desk and I go, okay, I can't take this anymore. So what are some of the coping strategies that you think might be useful for people who are can see themselves approaching burnout?
Yeah. And I think that's also from a story, but some of this, the things that are realized and after hearing other people's stories is that doctors do prescribe the outdoors and nature. In fact, a friend of mine who also walked through burnout, the doctor said to her, she was having severe panic attacks, and the doctor said, go and do gardening. And literally, she took time out, a gardening leave. Gardening and creative outlets is something that there's research to prove that you just get onto another zone. It bypasses all the problem solving, and we get into much more of the limbic brain, not the neocortex. And yeah, you just become engrossed in something that you're doing, and it really helps. So creative outlets, I chose pottery. My friend her husband is an incredible artist. So art and pottery, something creative, really helps. It does initiate your problem solving and your innovative approach to things. Certainly with pottery, there are lots of life lessons, and you're going one direction and then shucks, it's not working out how you pictured, and then you have to change. But it's like being in the bush, you know, you focused on finding animals, but it's not like draining or stressful, but you've got a different focus. You switch focus. So being outdoors, doing something creative, and then connection is like so key. And that is, I think, well, in pottery, it's like I call it clay therapy, because you can disconnect and withdraw from people and just do what you're doing, designing that piece, that masterpiece that you're working on. Or you can just come away from that and engage in conversation with the people around the room. So there's both the connection, and then there's something to be said for, you know, if you're working on a piece, an artwork piece or a ceramic piece, that you come back again and you pick up from the stories that you left off telling in the last week. So there's this weekly connection. So I think some sort of connection and belonging in a space that you really enjoy is great. I also, exercise is key. It like really helps with those happy endorphins. And there's also the running groups or cycling groups, and there's that connection, as well as the headspace and quiet time. That golfers told me also really does it for them. And my son is one of them. But yeah, I think one thing for me is that we need to have the happy endorphins of exercise, or, you know, just have that engagement, physical movement, challenge, and then the dopamine, you know, we do get a bit of a kick out of achievement. We need to find options that give us the dopamine and the happy endorphins. And then we also need to balance that with the serotonin, so the slowing down, so stopping, resting, being quiet. And the other hormone that's very helpful is the oxytocin, which is the connection, the feel-good factor of care, nurture, and just being part of a community, a family, just being part of something and being cared for and giving care and, yeah, appreciation. So I think those are some of the things, and celebration, the fun, bringing the fun back into life and into moments. And I think those things really are great strategies.
Do you have any additional things you'd like to add, Lorinda?
Thinking about this. I do a lot of applied theatre, in my work in improv theatre, and how much when we do that with teams, even though that's the collaboration is usually what we try to explore. But I was just reminded of how big a part play plays.
Yeah.
And reconnecting with that inner child and really just giving over to curiosity and play. I think there's a massive freedom in that. And it kind of gets you to naturally reconnect with your body without thinking about it. And I think the improv rules sets you free of everything that leads to burnout, actually, if you think about it. Because, and I just realized it as she was talking, I must try to do improv for burnout, actually. Mm. Because I think it does all this stuff. It's the complete opposite of all that organizational factors. Mm. And because it promotes curiosity, it promotes no mistakes, it promotes play and just having fun and just creating. So I do think, you just sparked something. Thank you, Laura Jean.
Yeah, I think, anything that completely engrosses you, that takes you out of your own mind. For me, it's like walking. When I used to do paragliding, because you're just so focused on that thing that you don't think about anything else. Mm. And I think if you've got something like that in your life, I think it's very, very useful to combat burnout.
Yeah, it's a quote that comes to mind. It just makes me think of Maya Angelou's, my mission in life is not to merely survive, but to thrive with some passion, compassion, humor, and style. And I think, just about really enjoying life and having that fun. I've worked in financial services a lot and it can get quite focused. And this was a motto in one of the teams that I coached: let's not just survive, let's thrive. But I think it's both in the workplace as well as those things outside the workplace that we're really passionate about that actually make us come alive.
Having worked in a corporate, I know how much you can get caught up in the bubble of the corporate. Everything becomes that. Your whole life becomes, what are you going to be doing next in work? So your whole, everything, it almost becomes like your whole universe is that work that you need to do and the people you're doing it with and the deadlines and all of that. And I think anything that can take you away from that bubble, just to give you a bigger and fuller whole life and not be so blinkered into, the company that you're working for. Are there any good books or internet resources that people might use to manage their burnout?
Well, I was thinking this is a good podcast to listen to because I think no matter where you are in your burnout process, you'll need to change. So, and then The Boundaries book by Townsend and Cloud. It's quite a popular book but that's something I prescribe a lot because I think boundaries is something you're going to have to do either way, but it's specifically in renegotiating boundaries when you decide to take care of yourself. That's very important. And then I'm a huge fan of Gabor Mate. I'm a huge fan of Bessel van der Kolk and all the trauma books. So The Body Keeps the Score, When the Body Says No, The Cost of Hidden Stress, that deals with how we are with negative emotions, which feeds into that false and limiting beliefs that you were mentioning earlier. So I thought to myself, if I have to pick three, that would be for me the key things, because you want people to start to recognize things in themselves and you want them to start owning their own process. So in order to do that, you need to become very, very aware of what's going on in your body, what's going on in your mind, what am I thinking about, how am I consuming thoughts. And if you get them to create that awareness, then they can start working with it. So for me, those are very important. And I know this is not directly related, but Gabor Mate wrote a book called In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts, which is actually about addiction, trauma and addiction. But in that book, it is just so, it becomes so clear how there's an addictive quality to so many things. And I think especially with this, it's almost like letting go of the addiction to work. And there he talks about, he uses a concept called the impartial observer. So he says the moment that you realize you've done something that you didn't want to do, instead of becoming self-critical, to say, where's my impartial observer? And that's the voice in your head that says, that's interesting that you did that. Why do you think, when last did you feel this way? What happened when that happened? And you can start to connect it to things in your past that are actually you're reacting in the moment to things that happened to you in the past. And although that's more trauma related, I do think burnout is a massive trauma. So those two fields for me coincide completely. And I think anything by him is worth reading. But that book in particular, it's not just about addiction. It is about the things we do every single day without without noticing mm-hmm. how we are getting deeper and deeper into a situation mm-hmm. and we're losing perspective. So for me, those are three, but I think Laura Jean might, we have a lot of book conversations, so maybe she can also add some ideas there.
Yeah, I was just listening to what you're saying about addiction, and the one thing that I haven't mentioned, which is quite a big thing, is the addiction of screen time. And because that is like that kind of fuels that dopamine. And it's also having teenage kids knowing that, you know, we've got some strategies actually from Juliet Funt's book. She talks about white space, literally being intentional about blocking out some time in your diary. So I think prevention is better than cure. And the other thing that she talks about is when we are, on our phones, we're in the room, but we're actually absent. Mm. So then she talks about phone narration and also parking your phones, having a parking station. Mm. And so just bringing in some of those preventative measures, for this addiction that we all actually have is screen time and phones. And just like, how do we actually prioritize face-to-face connection? So I think her books are great. And then Nancy Klein's Time to Think, just being proactive, preventative, rather than having to deal with the fallout. Those are two books that come to mind. Yeah. And then Essentialism, like Greg McGowan, doing less, better, and kind of that 80-20% rule, and letting the noise fall, and just focusing on the things you love and the things that you only you can do, that other people can't do. So what is it that you can contribute that other people can't, and add that value.
Yeah, thanks for that. I mean, I've got a long reading list already, and it's just got longer. but I'll definitely read those books as well. Is there anything else that you'd like to mention that we haven't discussed yet?
I was thinking about, I call it the phases of burnout, but that's not scientific. That's just my observations in dealing with people, because I meet people along the way. And then for me, it's important, if you're listening to this and you're thinking, oh, so many things resonate, like to understand, am I pre-burnout? Like I can feel I'm giving into too much. I'm not having good boundaries, that kind of stuff. And there for me, the essential thing is to get to the boundary stuff and reevaluate your goals. So that's kind of the work I'll do there if I see people are there. And just start to create perspective on what is important and where you want to spend your time. I loved you saying 40,000 weekends or weeks.
4,000 weeks. 4,000 weeks. That's what you get.
That is insane. But I think it creates perspective, because you don't realize. You wipe out your eyes and then it's 20 years later and you're like, what did I do with my life? So you want to prevent that. And then I usually get people in the middle, like while they're doing it started, they usually don't know they're in it. And then for that, it's also like there you start to deal with a lot of trauma signals. So to look out for that, and then just, it's very disillusioning to know. It's a bittersweet, like any other diagnosis. I work a lot with neurodiversity in adults, and like that diagnosis, it's relief, because finally you have a reason for why you're doing stuff. But it is just so harsh, because now I have this label, I have this thing, and I have to deal with it. So there's a lot of trauma involved in just being very compassionate with yourself in that phase specifically. And then the aftermath is where, okay, now all of this has happened, I've done all of these things, but what now? The what now part. And I think there's many ways to get out of that stuckness, because I feel between the two, there's this little, I don't know what to call it, like a hole that you fall into, and you're stuck, and you feel ambivalent about everything. You feel like you don't care about anything. And I think that is important to get to. That's the journey back to the self, where I usually work with people. But it's good to know that there's different phases, and to kind of try and figure out where you are along this path. Because for each part that you're in, there's different things to notice and different things to do. And I think that's important, just as you're listening and you're thinking, oh, maybe I am in it. And the other thing is, it's not a death sentence. like we have, you know, living proof right here that it's not a death sentence. But and the good news is that it can be overcome. But I highly doubt that people can do it completely on their own.
Mm.
I do think you need some form of either professional help or a really, really steady person in your life or network in your life who can be brutally honest with you and with a lot of compassion and help you through it. So to not be shy to reach out and say, I think I'm in trouble.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anything else you'd like to add that we didn't cover yet?
Yeah, I was just thinking about resilience, and I work a lot with neuroscience, and it is, you know, how are we framing the way we see situations? So if you think about going down rapids, and, you know, are you seeing that as a stressful situation, or, you know, are you seeing it as fun, or is there an opportunity for growth? So I think it's how we view things that when we look at neuroscience, we look at habit formation. Actually, another book is James Clear's Atomic Habits. And that's, you know, I think there's the therapy, if you're in it, the prevention to that is, you know, the connection to hope and forming healthy habits from the start. So that's what I would say is, from a neuroscience perspective, just thinking about what is going to look different. What's the replacement picture for the next time you're faced with similar patterns? Mm. And how do you interrupt those patterns in a preventative way?
Yeah, I think this has been such a useful conversation for me to learn more about what exactly burnout is and what it looks like and the phases and some of the healthy habits we can try and put in place to prevent it from happening or to manage it if it already has happened. So where can people find out more about you, Lurinda?
My website is www.lurindamaria.co.za. It's the beautiful Marias, M-A-R-E-E, not Maries. And, so I'm on the website and I'm based in Randburg and I can be found on LinkedIn as well. So any of those avenues.
Thanks. And you, Laura?
Yeah, my website's takenewground.co.za. You can send me an email, connect@takenewground.co.za. And I'm based in Bryanston. I'm also on LinkedIn. And yeah, I'd love to hear your backstory. Love to have a conversation.
It's been fantastic having you in the studio. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you. It's been really, really great to have the conversation.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.